Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. When readers open Valerie Borline's new book about Alec Murdoch, they will first encounter this epigraph from Cormac McCarthy. Quote, "You can find meanness in the least of creatures, but when God made man, the devil was at his elbow, a creature that can do anything," end quote. Murdoch is the disgraced South Carolina lawyer who killed his wife and 22-year-old son in 2021 in an attempt to distract people from his many years of drug addiction, embezzlement, and other financial crimes. Let me repeat that. He murdered his wife and son at his family's rural, isolated 1,700-acre hunting estate in an attempt to engender sympathy, on the assumption that people would believe his flimsy alibis. Valerie Borline covered the 2023 murder trial in the Lowcountry that ended with Murdoch sentenced to two life terms. She was in the courtroom throughout in her role as a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Borline's book, The Devil at His Elbow, chronicles all the madness of the Murdoch family, a family that ruled over a large swath of the Lowcountry for 100 years. Alec Murdoch's story extends through four generations of fraud and a living above the law, dating to a great-grandfather whose last act was driving in front of a train so that his family could collect a payout for what was anything but an accidental death. Valerie Borline joins me today to discuss the corrupt and cruel legacy of Alec Murdoch. Welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thanks for having me.
As you know, and many listeners may remember, this case and what led up to it captivated the nation because of its breathtaking twists and turns and Alec Murdoch's brazen behavior. I want to begin in October 2021. At this point, Murdoch has not been indicted for the murders, but he has resigned from the family law practice, staged a botched suicide, gone to rehab, and seen the 2018 death of his housekeeper reopened. At this point, Murdoch's lawyer, Dick Harpootlian, goes on Good Morning America to discuss some of Murdoch's regrets.
Well, obviously, the financial transaction issue is something he regrets. And obviously, getting Eddie Smith to kill him, he regrets. I will say to you, George, that the reason I'm on this show this morning is that the just thirst for knowledge about this case has driven a number of outlets to say things that are false.
So, Valerie, to me, the insanity of this case is encapsulated in that little exchange between George Stephanopoulos and Dick Harpootlian, because here he is explaining, sort of a side attempted murder to the heart of the matter. But give me your impressions of Dick Harpootlian and what he's trying to do there as we pick up the case at that point.
Well, Dick Harpootlian is a household name in South Carolina. He's a larger than life, well-regarded defense attorney, a senator, like a man who loves to be in the center of the ring. And what he's trying to do is change the story of what we were all seeing with our own lying eyes. I mean, something was hugely awry with what was going on at Alec Murdoch. And by October of 2021, it was evident, right? I mean, he was in jail. He was not quite in jail at this point, but he was, there were a bunch of things that had gone clearly awry, and it's hard, it's hard to defend a person whose actions are so, so intertwined, such a web, but he's trying to, and he's doing yeoman's work.
And other than the obvious, which is, this is a big payday, do you think that he took this case because it was a chance to be in such a huge spotlight?
Well, I think Dick will tell you, and he's certainly told me, it's not been a great big payday because Alec Murdoch is the money is gone. Where it is, we are not sure. But I think that, look, Dick Harpootlian has been, he's 75 years old. He has been in public life for a really long time, and he was a contemporary of Alec's grandfather. They were prosecutors together. There's a long relationship there. And then he was also friends with Alec's father, who was also a prosecutor for 20 years, or the head prosecutor, and he knew Alec. Alec was a huge, before we knew Alec Murdoch as this depraved person who's capable of the most monstrous evil, as the title gets at, you know, he was a hail fellow, well-met, really well-regarded South Carolinian. And, you know, Dick has said to me that when he was head of the Democratic Party in South Carolina, if they needed a donor at its campaign finance deadline, you call Alec Murdoch. He gave $90,000 over time to political candidates in South Carolina. So there was a long relationship there too. And remember that Dick Harpootlian and his partner, Jim Griffin, who is another very well-regarded defense lawyer, got involved with this case way back in 2019 with Paul Murdoch and the boat wreck involving Mallory Beach. So Dick has been on the case a long time, and it's been 5 years since the boat wreck, and he seems to be sticking with it very closely.
Given the sheer tonnage of what led to the murders and the sensational trial that followed, how hard was it for you to figure out what would go into the book and what wouldn't?
Oh my gosh, it was just so hard. I think I could have spent two more years and written 200 more pages. There's 450 pages as it is. I think it was hard because, and just even as a journalist, and you know this, just explaining to readers in a newspaper article the context in which these murders happen, the other deaths, the thefts, it takes you several paragraphs. And similarly, there's a whole lot of ground to cover. And what I tried to do in the book is explain kind of the petri dish that gave rise to Alec Murdoch, the Hampton County and the history there. And that also, you're very spoiled for choice. His father, his grandfather, and his great grandfather, as you mentioned, there are echoes in everything that he did in the past. And so I wanted to leave plenty of time to explore those as well.
So, and along those lines, there were podcasts and there were documentaries and obviously TV and newspapers and every kind of media coverage that you could think of. It was happening almost around the clock. How closely did you follow what others were doing?
Well, you know, we're journalists, right? And we want to get the scoop. We want to get it first. But also, you know, the fact that there were so many eyes on the story helped me in a lot of ways. I mean, it showed me the great interest in the ways that people were interested in it. But it also gave me a lot of context to pull from in a book. And so I was following it all incredibly closely. But I would say, you know, we do know this story very well, as you alluded to, but I kind of, in my mind, wrote this book for two people. The person who knows everything about the case, and I want them to find something surprising every other page, at least something they didn't know. And then also the person that knows nothing about the case, who heard all the noise kind of in the background, but didn't watch the Netflix or didn't listen to a podcast. I wanted to tell it kind of soup to nuts for that person too.
And I mentioned the epigraph from Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian. I mean, other than Cormac McCarthy and William Faulkner, I'm not sure, I guess a dash of Grisham. I mean, it is incredible how this story encapsulates so much of Southern history. And I'm guessing that had to have drawn you as someone who covers the American South and has done so for a long time.
Yeah, for sure. One of the chapters of the parts is the book is told in parts, as you would imagine. And one of the parts is called The Prince of Hampton County, because he really was. But it was also an allusion to the Prince of Tides. Mm-hmm. This takes place in Pat Conroy land. It's as lush and beautiful as you would expect. And you can't overstate, it gives me chills to think about. You just can't overstate the literary allusions and echoes in this case. It's epic. I mean, it's biblical, it's Shakespearean. And I wanted a title that reflected that richness.
And you write about Alec Murdoch himself, how he is a character, as you say, he goes from a hail fellow well met to this horrible monster, and he never loses his flair for the dramatic, good and bad. I think you quote someone saying that all these outbursts of emotion in the courtroom, it was snot, but never tears. Let's listen to Alec Murdoch addressing the courtroom on the day of sentencing.
Most of all, I'm sorry to Mags and Paw Paw. I would never intentionally do anything to hurt either one of them. Ever. Ever.
Now, Valerie, one of the things that you draw attention to in the book is what we heard Alec Murdoch say. He referred to Mags, his wife, and Pawpaw. Before the trial began, he always referred to his son as Paul, but he went to, you know, this more affectionate name to obviously engender more sympathy. Just take me through a little bit of that, of how that embodies Alec Murdoch's approach.
Oh, there's so much about that clip, just listening to it. Even that courtroom was packed. There's 200 people in that courtroom, but you could hear a pin drop, right? Even listening to that clip, it was so dramatic. There were so many moments where it's theatrical, and I wanted the book to reflect that. No, but the Mags and Pawpaw is really emblematic. He gave four actually lengthy hour-long plus interviews to law enforcement where he talked about Maggie and Paul. Never once did he refer to them as Mags and Pawpaw, ever, in his jail calls either. So it's always Maggie and Paul. So, you know, there's a real, he's a trial lawyer before he was disbarred. He is a personal injury lawyer, and that line of work involves emotion, understanding how to get people to feel something. And he, by all attempts, you know, accounts, is a master at that. One of the other things that leapt out to me is, did you remember that he said, I would never intentionally do anything to hurt Maggie and Paul. There were these telling words that he would say at times, and I think we all heard them.
When you watch someone for 6 weeks in the absolute worst of circumstances, and it's a small courtroom, and as you say, you can hear a pin drop. On the one hand, it's fascinating. It's horrible, but it's fascinating. And that's why a lot of us are interested in the story. But I'm just curious, for you, being that close to someone who you know did it, or you're pretty sure did it, what kind of reaction or emotion does that conjure in you?
Well, it was extraordinary to be, extraordinary to be in the room. It's such a small room, you know, it dates to 1820. And so the ceilings are high, but the quarters are tight, right? Mm-hmm. So the jury box is, you could reach out. I sat in the jury box to test this. You can reach out and touch the witness stand from the jury box. And that's how close the jurors were to him. And I was just three rows back and watched him every day, like you said. It's extraordinary. There were moments I can remember being shocked just sitting there at a break in the courtroom where everyone, at break in the court proceedings, everyone's bustling about. Creighton Waters is talking to Dick Harpootlian about some procedural thing. The jury is bustling out to go get something to eat. The press is talking amongst ourselves. Did we just hear what we just heard? And I just sat there and watched Alec Murdoch, and he was dead quiet, his hands steepled together. And he just was observing this maelstrom of activity that he'd set off, almost like the center, the eye of the storm, looking out at the storm very calmly and serenely. It was incredible.
We will have more with Valerie Borlein on this incredible story and her new book, The Devil at His Elbow. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest is Wall Street Journal reporter Valerie Borlein. She has just published her first book. It's called The Devil at His Elbow, and it tells the story of the downfall of South Carolina lawyer Alec Murdoch, who was convicted of murdering his wife and 22-year-old son in 2021 at the family's hunting estate. But Valerie, we were talking a little bit about watching all of this up close. And as you write about in the book, and people who have followed this case probably know, this is a very small town. This is a rural part of South Carolina. This is a part of South Carolina where the Murdoch family has essentially ruled everything that goes on. And their reach continued to intimidate people up through this trial. So I'm curious, have you seen any break in the fever, so to speak, since all of this happened?
You know, you're exactly right about how close everyone is. I paid very close attention during voir dire when they were choosing the jurors. And it was amazing the number of people. So if you think about a community the size of Walterboro or Colleton County, South Carolina, if you went to church the Sunday before jury duty and there's 100 people in your church, five of y'all got a summons. I mean, it is that small of a community. And there were people who stood up. One of the jurors who was sat, he said, "Well, my brother is a deputy," and he was the third person on the scene. And they're like, "That's fine. It's okay." Mallory Beach's first cousin, they're like, "Yeah, that's all right." This one woman, she was related. She had real close ties to the family, but it wasn't until she said that she was one of the head groundskeepers out at the wedding estate where the defense was staying. It wasn't until then that she was disqualified. This is a town where everyone knows everyone, and many of the jurors knew one another when they were sat. But, you know, no, I think we're at a different moment in the whole fever pitch of this story. But I hope that we're at a point where people remember why they were fascinated with it, this amazing amount of criminal activity, but also intrigue and this incredible drama, but want to make sense of it. And I think, what does it all mean? How did a person do that? And how could a person commit that kind of evil? And that's really what I tried to explore in the book, kind of the psychological underpinnings of all this.
But in terms of the mentality of the people who live there, and we're generalizing, obviously, but do you think that the conviction of Alec Murdoch, has that wiped away some of the intimidation, mystique? You know, this family was just sort of presiding over everything. Have people sort of looked at this now and said, okay, this is horrible. I certainly don't need to be, under the thumb of the Murdochs any longer?
Well, I think they're still reeling. I mean, I've spent quite a lot of time in Hampton County, including after the verdict, and I've got to know many people there. It's a shock to be at a community that small at the center of this massive story. That's shocking for one. But then in the absence of that family's leadership of 100 years, there's a vacuum, right? And it's difficult. And these are also people who've had relationships. You know, the Murdochs still live there. There's still family there that, you know, Alec's siblings have close relationships there. The law firm is still there. So it's complicated, and it's been hard. And I think they're still I feel like people would say we're in a period of transition from where we were for a long time to what comes next.
Now,
and I should add, there I talked to a lot of people down there who knew him, who went to school with him, who worked for him, and there is still there's a large number of people there who will tell you, I think he knows more than he's saying. I mean, his older brother has said that. I think he knows more than he's saying. And some people, they'll say, I think maybe he was there, but I still can't believe he would do it. These are people that sat and, you know, that knew Maggie and Paul, still can't quite wrap their head around the fact that he was convicted of it.
Wow. For context, we're speaking a little bit, as though everybody, and Valerie, you've been living with the story for a long time, so I certainly understand it. You mentioned Creighton Waters earlier. He was the prosecutor in the case. Mallory Beach, you also mentioned, she was the 19-year-old woman who died in a boat crash when Alec's son, Paul, was drunkenly steering the boat and ran into a bridge. So when we're referring to past deaths, Mallory Beaches is the one that really set everything off, because there was an attorney for her family who doggedly pursued Alec Murdoch. And as that went along, all of the other financial crimes that he had been engaging in for years and years were about to surface. I'm curious, Valerie, as you look at, years and years and years and years of this, and you mentioned there's a vacuum. Is the town, is it sort of shell shocked still, or, you know, like, is this still a topic day to day?
Oh, absolutely. I think shell shocked is probably the right word. It's a very close community. Hampton is a town of 2,000 people. It's twin town. Varnville's about the same amount, and it has, you know, some of the Charlotte is booming, right? Raleigh, where I live, is booming, but that community has the least net migration of any community in South Carolina, and in fact is slightly shrinking. Nobody moves there. Everybody knows one another. So I think shell-shocked is the right word, and I explore this in a book, but part of the legacy, the difficult legacy of the Murdoch law firm, they sue big companies, and they're very successful at it, and they get these outsized verdicts, and have and as a result, Hampton County, South Carolina, has this reputation as a judicial hellhole, a place that if a company gets sued in Hampton County, they're gonna pay dearly for it. And that has the kind of the perverse result of companies not wanting to settle there. So the economy is struggling. There's very little private employment beyond the law firm. So yeah, shell shock's the right word. Nothing. It's going to take a long. It took a long time for Hampton County to be the Murdoch's fiefdom, and it's going to take a long time for them to become something else.
And to your point. Here is a section from the book that I highlighted that goes into the conundrum of the Murdochs and the law firm and those large settlements. And you write, quote, "Murdochs perpetuated the illusion that they were Hampton's benefactors fighting for neighbors who had nothing. But their legal chokehold chased away businesses, deprived people of jobs, kept doctors from opening a practice, and made it more expensive to raise families. Because the county's tax base was so depleted, property tax rates rose far higher than in wealthier jurisdictions. Car insurance rates rose as well. The Murdochs were thriving as the town around them sank," end quote. What are a couple of examples of that?
I mean, just isn't that incredible that this place, you know, that it was a set piece of the Murdochs, their remarks in court. Many of them to say, you know, we fight for the little person. We're here for you. This is, I've been defending, my family's been defending the little man for 100 years. Mm-hmm. An example would be, you know, the roads are some of the most dangerous in the state, which means they're some of the most dangerous in the country. That section of I-95 that traverses Hampton County, if y'all have driven it, it's tough. It's tough, and it's I drove down there dozens of times, and I don't like to drive at night or in the rain. But imagine, you know, your insurance, your car insurance is perversely expensive to drive on rough roads, which means, you know, sometimes people get in really bad wrecks and they go to the Murdoch firm, and the Murdochs get these outsized verdicts and they take 40% of it. And it's, you know, it's a snake eating its tail. It's an Ouroboros, you know? So.
And that's a big part of the story of Alec Murdoch's story that you write about is these large verdicts from terrible accidents, car crashes, where he and the firm would make millions of dollars as part of their 40% cut. But he had gotten himself into so much personal turmoil between addiction to opioids and all the other things that he was doing, that wasn't enough. And that's the start of where he begins to defraud clients and insurance companies.
Yes, Alec Murdoch was making better than $1 million a year in an average year, just in legitimate income from the law firm and fees. But he was addicted to opioids. There's evidence to support that. But the prosecutor said his real addiction was to money and status. His real addiction was to perpetuating a lifestyle and perpetuating his family name. And he spent money. I've looked at 10 years of his spending. It's all in a massive spreadsheet. Money was going out the door as fast as it was coming in for him. The law firm has said there were nickel and dime type incidents of fraud, credit card fraud on the corporate card, paying for kids' private tuition, paying for groceries on the cards for expensive trip. But he got into stealing from his clients kind of suddenly and then all at once. It was borrowing from underage clients whose money was in a trust and they wouldn't miss it, he told himself. And he took it and then he paid some of it back. And then he stopped paying it back. And then he just took it. And then he started winning big settlements for clients, telling them, our firm is so powerful. My name is so powerful. I got you $1 million. And they would be thrilled. They got $1 million. That's life-changing money. And in fact, you know, he would take his 40%, but he'd actually gotten them $3 million. And he would take his 40% of that amount and then also the rest. So his thefts, as you look at them, is just it's a snowball running downhill, getting bigger and bigger over the course of a decade.
Well, it's breathtaking that it took that long for him to get caught. I mean, because these are not small amounts of money. And as you say, this is one of the absolute poorest places in the United States. I'm curious.
And he said as much when he was confronted. You know, he was confronted the Friday before Labor Day in 2021 by his brother and other members of the law firm. And he said, you know, I'm just surprised it took you this long. But if you think about it, there's one bank. And if you stand on, I've done this, if you stand on the steps of the law firm, you could see the bank. It's if you had a really good, really good arm, you could throw a football to the courthouse. And then you don't even have to have a good arm to throw a football from the courthouse to the bank. And guess whose godfather was the chairman of the bank? You know, Alec Murdoch's. And his backdoor neighbor that he grew up with was the chief executive of the bank. And he got away with it because nobody was looking. Nobody questioned him.
We talked a little bit earlier about being in the courtroom and observing Alec, but you just mentioned he has several siblings that live still in Hampton County. He has one surviving son, Buster, who was there in the courtroom. What kind of character conclusions did you draw about those people as you watched and listened to them?
Oh, and we were in very close quarters. So we saw and interacted with the Murdochs on a daily basis and exchanged pleasantries and spoke because, you know, you're standing in line with them at the water fountain, you know? But I think that and Buster, his elder son, lives one county south of Hampton. He's right in the area. I think one of the things that is very telling, and I saw this myself, they asked to sit in the middle, but out of deference to Maggie and Paul, because if you think about it, the closest people to the victims was the family. And they wanted to split their allegiance to the victims and then also to the person accused of killing those victims. And, you know, the fire code says you can't do that, or anybody says you can't, common sense says you can't do that. They ended up sitting behind Alec. But, you know, one of the things that I noticed is that no one was in the courtroom as a regular presence for Maggie and Paul. Typically, you would see a victim's family sitting behind them or friends. And there was one day where one of her sorority sisters was there. I found out, I talked with her later about it, but no visible presence. But yeah, I think the conclusion you can draw, I think what they were telling us with their presence was they were a family, they're a unit. To this day, they're still proud and defensive of their family name in spite of what Alec Murdoch has been, the many, many crimes he's been convicted of.
Relatively speaking, do they still have money, the Murdoch family?
Relatively speaking, yes, absolutely. And I think the family is very wealthy. They're very Alec Murdoch, I think anyone in Hampton would tell you that Alec Murdoch lived the flashiest of any Murdoch who's ever lived. They lived modestly, comparatively speaking. Alec had the biggest cars. He had the private planes. You know, the rest of the family blended in a little bit more like wealthy people might in a small town, like you might expect. But no, I think that Alec's, you know, his father, Randolph Murdoch III, died just days after Maggie and Paul were killed and left a substantial estate on the order of $16 million or so, as I understand it. And so that money goes to his children. And it's not, you know, it's not subject to Alex Murdoch's many misdeeds.
Okay, so that is not going to be used to repay any of his victims.
Well, not the money that goes to his siblings.
Okay. What kind of reception and cooperation did you get as you reported on first the stories for the Wall Street Journal, but then later went back for the book?
Well, I think, you know, that Hampton was under siege. In fairness, the nation was captivated internationally. We were captivated by the story. And this is a small town where, like I said, everyone knows everyone. And they felt under siege. And so the first couple trips I made to Hampton, I felt unwelcome. More so, I've been a reporter for 30 years, always in the South, principally in North and South Carolina. And I felt unwelcome. And I had been to Hampton before, many years before on a reporting trip. I reported some stories there. But with the book, the luxury was I got to go back again and again and talk to people and try to get below the surface. You know, I know if when they're not six TV reporters doing stand-ups on the courthouse lawn, you have the benefit of sitting for a while, literally I did this more than once, sit on a front porch with a glass of lemonade and even a slice of pound cake and talk with people. And so that's really where the history of the book came out. Well, you think Alec is something, you should have known his grandfather. Let me tell you a story. And so I found the people of Hampton to be, over time, very warm, very receptive, and also, like you said, shell-shocked and hurt and not sure what comes next, because there's the person that they knew, they didn't know, and then the legacy of the family, which they did know, is changing.
We're going to let Valerie Borlein tell us some more stories. We're going to take one more break, and then we're back right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We're continuing our conversation with Valerie Borlein. She is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal who often writes about the South, and her first book, The Devil at His Elbow, has just been published. We spoke a little bit earlier about the poverty and inequities that run through this part of South Carolina that the Murdochs ruled. Hampton is named, as you write, for a slaveholding Confederate general who terrorized freed blacks after the Civil War. Much of the population, black and white, suffers from poor health care, poor schools, lack of access to healthy food. Do you think anything will change without the Murdochs running things?
In the South, in South Carolina in particular, you can't escape the difficult legacy of chattel slavery. You just can't. And in the Low Country in particular, the I-95 corridor that traverses South Carolina, the corridor is called the Black Belt, meaning because of the soil. The soil was very rich, and there was a lot of rice and indigo, and perversely, therefore, a lot of slavery. And Hampton County is predominantly Black. And one of the that shocked me as I was reporting the book, I called multiple historians to verify this. Hampton County from Beaufort County, the where Hilton had, they seceded after Reconstruction to be an expressly white county, to reestablish the way things were, quote unquote, before the Civil War. And the Murdochs moved there. And that's the point when they moved to that place to be part of the Confederate Old Guard. You know, Alec's great-great-grandfather was a Confederate officer, and they moved there to kind of run the place. And so there still is this difficult legacy of generational poverty there. For Alec Murdoch to make $1 million in a place where the average income is, you know, half of the national income, it really is perverse and a strange strange circumstance. So no, I think I have hope because I have hope. Mm-hmm. And I like the people I know there, but it's very difficult to see how you get out of the box that you're in when history has set a table for hundreds of years.
Was there, I mean, inherently there is resentment, I would think, whether it's voiced or not. As you mentioned, when you see some neighbors making $1 million and you may not make that much in your lifetime, but when the family and Alec were put on trial and all of this sordid history comes out, did you ever get any sense of, you know, people kind of spiking the football and saying, well, see, there you go. This whole thing has been unfair and, you know, it's just stacked against us. And this is an example.
I think that people, we probably feel this in our own families. I think, you know, I could say things about my family, but I wouldn't want anybody else to say them. So I think there's a little bit, it's a little bit more like that. I think there's, it was hard to have, they were feared, but they were also loved. It's a very complicated relationship. Very complicated. So no, I have not gotten a sense of spiking the football at all.
Have you been back since, you know, since everything kind of settled?
Yes. Yes. I actually rented a house down there for a while after the verdict and to conduct interviews, talk to people. The dust is still settling. There's a big controversy in Hampton right now, a matter of several million dollars that's missing from the administration, and it's causing a crisis in the schools and a lot of finger pointing. And these, the people that are involved, or some of them are Murdoch sympathizers and kind of got their political roles in part because of the Murdoch family, and some are trying to unwind the system. So it's, you know, the dust hasn't settled.
Have you asked for an interview with Alec Murdoch at any point, or would you?
Oh, 1,000%. I mean, of course I would. I'd love to talk with him. But I think if you think about Susan Smith, the Susan Smith case years ago, we have not heard from her since she entered the Department of Corrections, right? And that's just, the South Carolina Department of Corrections has an incredibly strict policy about journalists talking to convicted felons. It doesn't happen as a matter of just policy. It doesn't happen. So my chance, I was hopeful I get to talk to him. It will not happen as long as he's in South Carolina prison. But I think, you know, I think we all got hours and hours and hours of Alec Murdoch on the stand, not just in the trial and in the cross-examination, but also again in Buford when he spoke for an hour about from his heart, just what he wanted to say. And I sat there, and in Buford in particular, during his sentences on the state financials, they sat us in the jury box. So I was about 30 feet from him. And I, at one point, he started talking about the media and how the media had besmirched his family name. And I just put down my notebook and just looked at him like, wow, this is where, and it just struck me. And I talked to Creighton Waters, a prosecutor, about it later. He gave this soliloquy that was so indicative of who he is. And it was clear to everyone but him what he was saying, you know. It was, so I would love to interview him, but in some respects, I think it's a fool's errand, because I don't think, and the Judge Newman, the judge who presided over all the proceedings, said as much, that he's a mystery to himself.
One of the things that you write about in the book is that when he does go to jail, he almost instantly kind of picks up with his character, his way of ingratiating himself, deal cutting. He is already in the mix. It's not millions of dollars, but he's, what, bartering candy bars and cigarettes or whatever it is.
It's astonishing, but it's not, right? I mean, there were hours and hours and hours, dozens of hours of jail calls that were recorded where he tells us how he's setting up his barter economy within the jail. Well, you know, I was able, he's asking his son Buster to put more money in his, put all the money they can, $60 a week, in his commissary account, but also put in $60 in this other guy's commissary account. That guy gets $15, and then Alec gets the delta to spend on honey buns and ramen. So then he can buy other things and favors. So I think that there is a wiring in Alec Murdoch that, you know, our wiring doesn't change. Our and I write about this. I think he's removed from the web that is Hampton County, but he's a spider that's removed from that web, but he's spinning another web wherever he lands. Dick Arbutlian told me this. He said, you know, it's curious. Ehrlich is the first white, when he was jailed while he was waiting for his trial. And he's the first white collar defendant he'd ever had that wasn't banging at the door to get out of jail.
Oh, that quote stunned me. Yes, I do remember that. Yeah. He just adapts to wherever he is.
No.
I'm curious. One of the things that you write about is how Ehrlich stayed close to his in-laws even after he had murdered their daughter. Did they continue to believe in him all the way through, or do you have any sense of that?
My sense of his in-laws, Maggie's parents, they're old and they're in poor health, and it was just devastating beyond imagining what happened to them for them to even fathom it. And my understanding is that they have been supportive of him over time. There's a sense that yes, the financials, you can see it in black and white, he was stealing, but it's unfathomable to them that he would have killed Maggie, his college sweetheart, and Paul, his beloved son. Those two were two peas in the pot. So, you know, my understanding from the family is they're supportive.
You mentioned Creighton Waters a couple of times. He was the lead prosecutor. Let's listen to the beginning of his closing argument.
Good morning. It's been a long trial, hasn't it? On June 7th, 2021, at the Moselle property in Colleton County, Maggie Murdoch and Paul Murdoch were brutally and maliciously murdered at the kennels by Ehrlich Murdoch. Paul, as you know, suffered two shotgun blasts. Maggie suffered five blackout rifle wounds. And after an exhaustive investigation, there is only one person who had the motive, who had the means, who had the opportunity to commit these crimes, and also whose guilty conduct after these crimes betrays him.
Valerie, as we've mentioned several times, you were in the courtroom the whole way through. What did Creighton Waters do to clinch this conviction? In other words, were you impressed with his work?
Well, you know, it gives me chills to hear that, because I had the privilege of accompanying the jury out to Moselle that morning. So that morning, they had just gotten back from this 30-minute drive out into the countryside, out into the middle of nowhere, out to Moselle, and spent, you know, an hour walking the property. So when he mentions the kennels, they had just stood in the kennels, you know, an hour before. And I saw them, the thing that's, I got as chance as the print reporter, who was the pool reporter, to spend time in the kennels myself after they left. What I saw them doing was standing in the room where Paul, the feed room where Paul was shot. I saw them standing where Maggie fell. And what strikes you when you're on Moselle, it's 1700 acres. It's swamp, it's pine trees, it's enormous. It's twice the size of Central Park, but the kennels are tight. And they had just stood there in this tight quarters where Paul and Maggie died 12 steps apart from one another. So when he says he shot them brutally at the kennels that morning, that's what was going through my mind. And I feel certain that's what was going through their mind. To your question, I think Creighton Waters became the foremost student of Ehrlich Murdoch in the world. I think he knew Ehrlich Murdoch's misdeeds better than Ehrlich Murdoch did himself. So I think that he made a meticulous case. He marshaled every resource. There was a half a dozen prosecutors who had witnesses, but it was Creighton that marshaled them. So I think he, you know, he certainly worked his fanny off. He lost a ton of weight, and he I think got a conviction. which in a case that was by no means certain that he would.
You mentioned Moselle, which is the name of the hunting estate where the Murdochs lived. And there's a, you include in the book a photo of yourself standing at the estate, you know, looking out at the crime scene. There's the reporting side of you that's chronicling lists and adding all the pieces together. But the personal, emotional side, what is it like to stand at a place that Dick Harpootlian said gave him the creeps?
You know, it was shocking, honestly. And I have a son, and Maggie and I are very close in age. I grew up in Wilmington. She spent her junior high school years in Wilmington. We knew people in common. I did not know her, but I think as a human, it was very emotional. And I talked to jurors afterwards. I talked to a lot of the law enforcement. You know, Deputy Rutland was out there. The security that was there with the jurors were some of the same deputies that were there that night. Every single person used the same word that I felt, which was heaviness. There was a heaviness in the air, and it's so quiet and so remote. All you could hear were birds. I was like, what can I hear out here? Can I hear a plane? Can I hear any cars going by? No, it's so remote. And so it was as a human, just knowing that this place also was Paul's happy place in particular. He was an outdoorsman, and he loved Moselle. He never wanted to leave Moselle. He wanted to start a business, a logging business out there. And to think that a father could lure, because the evidence showed he did lure them home. They had no plans to come home that night, to lure them there to this place that was so magic in their family and now is inextricable from this horrific act. You know, it was a very heavy experience.
And Moselle, by the way, is, I guess, unclaimed, for lack of a better term. I mean, it's just sitting there. At least that's how you end the book, I believe.
Well, Moselle has been sold, and to a neighbor, actually, and the house is being sold separately.
Okay, so that's happened since.
Yes. But I should mention, I mean, you mentioned the photographs. There are eight pages of photographs in the book. And there's also a lengthy list of characters because, you know, we were talking about all the different crimes and all the different names earlier. It's like Dostoevsky, right? I mean, there's it really is a challenge to keep up with everything. And I wanted to give, and there's a map or multiple maps. I mean, I wanted to give readers as close a guide as I could to following this, you know, incredible story. Because it's an American saga, and it's an honor to get to tell it.
I'm curious, you know, obviously we all gravitate to just the lurid nature, the atmospherics, the horror. There are all these elements to it, but you work at the Wall Street Journal and you have a business reporting background. How much did that help you, given that there's so much financial malfeasance in the story?
Well, you know, it's interesting. From the very beginning, when I started writing a story, I asked my editor, I was like, well, what is the Wall Street Journal version of the story? And he was like, Val, sometimes a good story is just a good story. And so I sort of went in with that in mind. But as it turns out, you're right. It was a classic Wall Street Journal story because it's about money and power and politics and how money makes things move around. And I've been at the Journal for 19 years. I've come to understand that all stories have some element of money and systems and how they work together. So I think it did help me. It certainly helped me with the spreadsheets and the financials, but I think it also helped me just in terms of the framing in my mind. Like, Alec Murdoch was the product of a system, and that was a system of privilege. It existed for a reason, and it was perpetuated for a reason.
Well, Valerie Borlein, I appreciate you being with us here today on Charlotte Talks.
Thanks so much for having me. Y'all are a real institution in North Carolina, so I feel fortunate.
Valerie Borlein is the author of The Devil at His Elbow. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.